Hi there, it's Marco. Because you listen to The World, you know that we've been closely following the war in Ukraine for months, even as it was just beginning to develop. Correspondents Daniel Offman and Duri Buscarin brought you stories from the ground in Ukraine and Romania as the conflict escalated. We've been able to call on experts like Bill Browder to discuss the impact of sanctions against Russia. And you've heard from the people at the center of these events, like Oksana Kolesnik, who fled Chernihiv with her daughter and is now the director of the new Warsaw Ukrainian School in Poland. The World's reporting has helped you better understand the war in Ukraine. This kind of nuanced, human-centered reporting is only possible because of listener support. Please consider donating now to our fundraiser before June 30th. You can make your gift and learn more at theworld.org/give or follow the link in our episode notes. Help power our newsroom today at theworld.org/give. Thanks, and now the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
A nuclear watchdog in Sweden offers a bleak assessment. Nuclear states will be expanding their arsenals.
They're using them more directly in threatening, and when they talk about nuclear weapons and the importance in their military strategies.
Also ahead, a visit to a history museum in Ukraine. Its main focus is World War II, but today's war has changed the museum's mission.
We understood that it is our responsibility to prepare the project devoted to this large-scale Russian invasion.
I'm Carolyn Beeler, and after 60 years of dominating the Olympics, Cuban boxers are finally hearing this.
Julio César La Cruz!
Stepping into the ring as professional boxers, that's all ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It was a controversial idea from the start, sending asylum seekers arriving in the United Kingdom to Rwanda, where they'll be allowed to resettle if they win their asylum cases. That's the British government's controversial plan, and it's come under enormous criticism from human rights groups. A number of charities working with migrants and asylum seekers challenged the policy in court in London this afternoon, but the first plane still looks set to depart tomorrow night. The World's Orla Berry joins us from London. Orla, before we get into what happened in court today, refresh my memory on the background here. How did this plan come about?
Sure. So in April, the government announced this plan, which it said was introduced to combat people smuggling into the UK. The plan targeted single men in particular who were arriving from across the Channel from France, whether on these small dinghies or hidden in the backs of trucks. And the government said these asylum seekers would now be sent to Rwanda to have their claims processed there. If their claim was successful, they would be allowed to stay in Rwanda for up to 5 years. If they failed, then they'd face deportation or they could apply for asylum through other immigration routes. But it's important to say that even if their application was successful, they would not be returning to the UK. And many human rights groups, as you mentioned, came out and said this policy was absolutely inhumane.
And those human rights groups were in court today with an appeal for tomorrow's flight to be stopped. What was the outcome?
That's right. The appeal was brought by this coalition of groups. So that involved two charities who work with migrants and refugees and also a union which represents mainly Border Force staff here in the UK. In other words, government workers whose job it is to process these deportations. And last Friday, this same group sought an injunction, an emergency injunction, to try and stop the flight going ahead. But the judge ruled against them. So they appealed that decision today in an appeal court. But once again this afternoon, they lost and the flight is now set to go ahead tomorrow. And the head of the union representing Border Force staff, Mark Sawatka, just gave his reaction a short time ago to the BBC.
Obviously, it puts Home Office staff now in a dreadful position, because tomorrow a flight is due to deport people against their will to Rwanda. but it is not yet known whether or not that is a lawful process. But it's even worse for those people who will now tragically be deported, people who have come from Iran, from Afghanistan, from places to escape torture and persecution against their will. They will be sent tomorrow to East Africa. And I think that's a desperately sad day for this country and believe overall this process to be deeply inhumane.
And I should say, Carolyn, by the way, this isn't the end of it, because a full hearing into the government's policy to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is actually still scheduled for July. So, you know, today's appeal was part of this emergency injunction to stop the flight. But a full exploration of the actual legality of the government's plan is still set to happen in July. So those people who are going on the flight tomorrow could actually end up being brought back to the UK in a month's time, depending on what happens at the July hearing.
Oh my gosh, what a mess. So who is supposed to be on this flight tomorrow?
Well, originally around 130 people had received letters, we understand, saying they were going to be sent to Rwanda. But last week we heard that only 37 people were actually scheduled to be on the flight. We don't know too much about them. We do know that one of them is a former policeman from Iran, and it's reported that he fled Iran after being sentenced to prison for refusing orders to shoot at protesters during an anti-government demonstration back in 2019. And he was facing a 5-year jail term in Iran, and he fled first to Turkey and then to the UK. And his lawyer argued that Rwanda isn't a safe place for him because he fears he could be killed by Iranian agents in Rwanda. Now we understand today that he's no longer going to be on that flight. Not only that, but of the 37 scheduled to go, the figure dropped to 11 people this morning because of all the legal challenges. And of those 11, we know 4 are from Iran. There's 2 Iraqis, 2 Albanians, 1 person from Syria. And then we don't know the nationalities of the other 2. But then this afternoon, we heard the figures had dropped to single digits. So, you know, there will only be a handful of people going at all tomorrow if this flight does take off at all. And in fact, some government sources are saying this afternoon it may well not happen because the numbers are just so small.
Orla Berry is the world's Europe correspondent. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carolyn.
In northern China last week, 4 young women rejected the advances of a stranger in a restaurant. And then they were attacked by a group of men. The incident was caught on security cameras, and the video has caused a social media storm in China. The World's Rebecca Kanther joins me from Shanghai with more. Rebecca, what does this video exactly show happened?
A group of women were eating a meal together at a barbecue restaurant on Thursday night. A man approached one of the women and touched her. She pushed him away twice, rejecting him. And then he began attacking her, and a group of other men rushed into the restaurant, dragged the woman outside, and brutally beat them. And this was all captured on security footage. Someone posted it online, and then it just spread really quickly on the weekend, and 2 of the women had to go to the hospital for treatment.
Wow, what a horrible story. But unfortunately, women are violently assaulted, you know, every day all over the world. Why do you think this particular case has caused such an uproar?
I spoke to a number of women, and what I heard from them was that in one sense, this was very shocking to see such brutal behavior in public. But on the other hand, this is just another in a series of news about gender violence that has just come out over the past year. And it's just one more, and it's very upsetting. I spoke to one woman, April Joe, and she said she was really angry when she saw the video. She said everybody is talking about it. She's been having conversations with both men and women all about the video.
评论区里面会有一些这样子的观点，就是觉得女生怎么这么晚还在外面吃。
She's saying usually when one of these incidents occurs, there are people online who will try to blame the victim. They'll say, why was she walking alone? Why was she wearing those clothes? But in this case, it's very clear. You can see in the video, she did nothing wrong. She just didn't want to be touched. That's her right as a person. And people aren't just upset about the attack. They're also upset that during the attack, nobody came to the woman's aid. This is something that's causing a lot of discussion and anger. Another young woman named Cici Huang told me that watching this video solidified something that she'd been feeling for the past 2 years.
我越来越确定我是一个女权主义者，并且我觉得这件事情是不需要经过任何思考的。这件事情会让我
She's saying, I know now that I am a feminist. I've seen too many of these gender-based violent attacks in the past few years. This incident just shows how patriarchal Chinese society is.
So what's happened to the men who assaulted these women?
So 9 men were arrested in this incident. But curiously, another city 90 miles away has been given the responsibility of handling the investigation. And some people are saying that that's because maybe the men involved could have had connections with local police or local gangs. But Chinese state television issued a commentary asking for harsh punishment for the men.
So there's been this big uproar. Do you have any sense yet of whether there could be some longer lasting impact from this incident and all the attention that it's gotten?
Well, in China, feminism has been under attack. Feminist groups have had their posts scrubbed from the internet and have been threatened by government supporters. But at the same time, videos that show gender violence have been going viral on social media. I spoke with Xu Fei, who's a feminist organizer in Shanghai, and she says she's seeing more interest in gender equality on social media, but whatever real change there's going to be is going to be slow and incremental.
You can see that the number of people are reading about it and their understanding about this is growing day by day. I noticed the video on Weibo has been taken down. And so I think they would take action to take down some of them, but they will not be able to take down all of them. But I don't think people will forget.
When these videos of gender violence go viral in China, there's a lot of debate about gender inequality, but so far we haven't seen any real changes.
The World, Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
The Chinese territory of Hong Kong has changed radically since Beijing imposed its harsh security law in 2020. Hong Kong's 7 million citizens now face severe penalties if they criticize the Chinese Communist Party. Nearly 50 people on trial for protesting right now face the possibility of life in prison. Religious leaders do not get a free pass in Hong Kong, and churches are becoming political battlegrounds. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
In China, the road to becoming a Catholic bishop runs through the Chinese Communist Party. Only priests approved by Beijing can do the job, under an agreement signed 4 years ago by the Vatican. This does not sit well with many Chinese Catholics. Here's Cardinal Joseph Zen of Hong Kong.
A person with a blessing from Beijing means they are sure that person is ready to be on his knees to obey completely to the regime.
That's Cardinal Zen speaking to Catholic media 2 years ago. The 90-year-old might not openly criticize Beijing moving forward. He was arrested last month and released on bail. His charge? Helping raise legal fees for anti-government protesters. Hong Kong authorities say religious leaders have to follow the law, too. But China may find it difficult to cut and paste rules imposed in the mainland onto churches in Hong Kong.
It's not a rubber stamp of any place else. Hong Kong is Hong Kong, and I think that has to be respected.
Robert Carbonneau is a historian with the Ricci Institute for Chinese Western Cultural History at Boston College. He's also a priest. 1 in 20 Hong Kongers are Catholic, and Father Carbonneau says they are uniquely multicultural, many coming from outside countries to work in offices or to work as housekeepers.
Half of the population are non-Hong Kong citizens who are Catholic. That raises a totally different parameter because the world is watching what goes on in Hong Kong.
A third of Catholics in Hong Kong are actually Filipino migrant workers. But the most vocal Catholics are at opposing ends of a political divide. Hong Kong's chief executive enforcing the harsh laws on speech is John Lee. He just took over from Carrie Lam. Both are Catholic. And then there are Hong Kong priests who say those leaders are agents of religious oppression. Here's Father Vincent Wu of Hong Kong.
In the face of persecution, in the face of oppression, we have to resist. We cannot cave in. We have to fight to the end. We have to fight to the day we die.
A recent interview with Father Wu in Catholic media. He says he may be the last priest in Hong Kong who will speak out against Beijing.
If you call any parish in Hong Kong and ask, you know, to interview any priest, I'm sure no one would dare to pick up your phone call.
He may be right. I contacted several Christian leaders in Hong Kong who said giving an interview right now is too dangerous. Even Father Wu's seminary told me he's not approved to speak with you. I asked Father Carbonneau from Boston College when it's okay for Catholic priests to veer into activism.
I believe it depends on the will of the priest and the community.
He says priests and their flock need to make this decision together. The Vatican says priests should not get active in politics unless, big caveat, the common good requires it.
It's not a top-heavy management style. It's It's one where the local people are believers. They know their situation best. The respective bishops know, the cardinals know.
Most priests and pastors in Hong Kong appear to be playing it safe, taking anything that might sound political out of their sermons. They do have to register with the government to preach, and that privilege can be taken away. In mainland China, Beijing can stop any priest deemed anti-government from getting approved. Does that also apply to Hong Kong, which is traditionally semi-autonomous from the mainland? It's not clear, because the China-Vatican deal is kept secret. It's up for renewal this October.
It's a very anxious moment. But I think with that anxiety, there is a real hope. How that's going to manifest itself is also an unknown dimension.
Father Carboneau says Hong Kong's Catholic community has been around for 180 years, surviving wars and multiple changes in government. He says it will find a way to persevere. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
One museum in Kyiv has gotten a jump start on history. It's already showing an exhibit based on the ongoing Russian invasion. Our interview with the curator is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Historians sometimes say that trying to write history as it unfolds is like looking at yourself in the mirror from an inch away. They need some time and distance to evaluate all the facts. But one museum in Kyiv isn't waiting. The National Museum of the History of Ukraine and the Second World War is already running an exhibit about Russia's current invasion of the country. Dmytro Hynetdinov is the head of the museum's education department. He recently spoke from Kyiv with The World's Marco Werman.
Dmytro, take us, if you will, inside the exhibit. What's on display and what do people see when they're at the museum?
First of all, the most unique feature of this exhibition is that it is the first ever exhibition on the ongoing Russian-Ukrainian war. It consists of three chapters. The first chapter displays the materials of the Russian occupiers, their weapons, their uniforms, their equipment. The second chapter is devoted to the destruction which occurred in the Kyiv region. And the third chapter is the authentic and detailed reconstruction of the shelter where the residents of Hostomel in Kyiv area lived under occupation during 37 days.
So obviously Ukraine is still in the middle of this war fighting Russia's military. How are you and your team at the museum able to tell the story of a war that's ongoing? I mean, how up to date is the exhibit?
You're right. It is a very special thing to create the exhibition on the ongoing events. And maybe I should quote our curator, Mr. Yuri Savchuk. He said that the idea to prepare the projects on the ongoing war came to him right on March the 5th, when he witnessed the replacement of the big Ukrainian flag on the square of our memorial. In our memorial complex, we have the largest national flag in Ukraine, and this flag was flying over the territory of memorial on the first day of the war, on February 24th. And when it was replaced, our director and curator asked the officers to donate this flag to museum as the first artifact of the wartime. And after this, as soon as the liberation of the Kyiv area and Chernihiv area was completed, it was the 2nd of April, in 3 days, on April the 5th, Yuri Savchuk led the first museum expedition to the areas of hostilities. Bucha, Irpin, Hostomel, Vorzel, Borodyanka, and other locations. And what the museum team saw there was absolutely shocking experience, of course. And these expeditions was the first step to prepare this project.
Well, I mean, it sounds like some objects in the exhibit have symbolic quality, like that flag. But as for like the atrocities in Bucha and what you all saw from the museum, how do you represent such devastating events?
Of course, it is absolutely impossible to represent all the facets of war in any exhibition. That is why we tried to focus on few particular things. First of all, to demonstrate the army which came to Ukraine, not only stepping beyond the Ukrainian borders, I mean the Russian army, but also stepping beyond the laws and principles of war, laws and customs of war. Our second intention was to demonstrate the consequences of the war in Ukraine through the destructions, through the suffering of the civilians under the occupation, through the horrific living conditions of people who lived in the basements under occupation without permission to go outside. We want to demonstrate the real consequences of the Russian invasion and to raise the awareness of not only the Ukrainian society about the war, but also the international audience.
So, Dmytro, we know the maxim that truth is the first casualty of war. So as war is going on in real time, how do you actually reflect on something that's so immediate and so close and you feel like you are zeroing in on something like the truth?
I can say that probably the most sensitive thing which we see every day in our work is conversation with the visitors. And the visitors are the real markers on how actual this topic is and how this war is actual for them. As we have here not only very numerous groups of forcibly resettled people, but also the ones who had to flee from the war, for example, from East Ukraine or South regions of Ukraine. And we understand how painful this topic is for them. And speaking to them every day, we realize that this war is ongoing right now. Very often we meet people who, for example, lived under the occupation or they lived in the basements without electricity, without heating. And they said very often that we lived in very similar conditions that you describe in your exhibition. But no one told us that it is not actual as because they saw or because they faced the same difficulties. In contrast, people said that it is very important right now to highlight the consequences of the war. And we demonstrate our respect and our sensitive attitude to the stories of people who lived in the real conditions of war.
So your museum, Dmytro, in Kyiv is primarily, as I said, a World War II history museum. Interestingly, from the start of this war, Russian officials have used the history and memory of World War II to somehow justify the war in Ukraine. How do you react to that?
I can use just one sample from our exhibition. You know that in Russian propaganda, the most typical statement regarding Ukraine is that Ukraine is a Nazi or fascist state, but these are just words. And the reality is in our exhibition, we have the installation consisting of the fragments of the Soviet war memorials devoted to the Soviet warriors of the World War II. And these memorials were destroyed by the Russian artillery. And right now we see here in Ukraine the attempts of the Russian Federation to restore the orders of the World War II period or interwar period.
Dmytro, what does your work that you've put on for this exhibit, what does it mean for you personally, especially at a time like this?
I work as a head of the educational department, and I'm working on this position since 2017. Before this, I worked as a tour guide in this museum. And in Ukraine, where the historical memory of World War II is very complicated, when we have so multiple experiences of people who lived in World War II period, many things in the civil education of the young generation depend on the studying of World War II. And that was very strong motivation for me and for my colleagues before the aggression. But right now, we feel the double responsibility as we want the museum to be the informational center of this war. This is the issue of citizenship and the issue of the historical justice. We want to feel our work is necessary for the society. We try to be in the heart of the informational resistance. Right now, the aggression against Ukraine by the Russian Federation is observed in different dimensions, not only military dimension, but also ideological and informational. And we don't want to produce a new propaganda, but we want to be the center of information and the center of spreading the truth about this barbaric Russian invasion of our country.
Dmytro, thank you very much for speaking with us today about your museum and how you're approaching the history that's unfolding right now in Ukraine. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All the best.
That's Dmytro Hynet-Dinov, the head of the education department at the National Museum of the History of Ukraine and the Second World War in Kyiv, speaking there with the world's Marco Werman. More stories from around the globe are coming your way. You're listening to The World. In much of Africa, a neurologist can be hard to find. One woman with multiple sclerosis spent years trying to get a diagnosis until a chance encounter with a specialist.
And she said, "I'd like to give you a consultation. I'm willing to come because I want to give a name to whatever I'm suffering from."
A new neurology program is upending medical assumptions ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. When it comes to boxing, Cuba punches above its weight. Cuban boxers have been winning Olympic medals for decades, but since the early 1960s, they haven't been allowed to fight for money. Now, that's changing. The communist country is lifting its 60-year ban on professional boxing. The World's Tibi Saisea has the story.
Boxing has been big in Cuba for more than 100 years. It started as a tourist attraction featuring fights with North American boxers, but it got really popular with the locals, and they went on to become world-class champions.
September 18, 1953, Syracuse, New York. Kid Gavilan, the Cuban Hawk, defending the world's welterweight title against Carmen Basilio, the challenger from nearby Canastota, New York, in a scheduled 15-round bout. Round one.
Kid Gavilan was the undisputed world welterweight champion for years. He and other boxers from that period are considered national heroes in Cuba. But not long after the communist revolution, Fidel Castro banned all professional sports in 1961. He said athletes were exploited by big economic powers. Still, Cuban fighters excelled at the Olympics and the amateur system. In fact, in the last 10 years, Cuba has won more Olympic boxing medals than any other country.
Médaille d'or et champion olympique, Cuba!
What an incredible moment for Julio La Cruz, 31 from Cuba, now an Olympic gold medalist.
That's from the Tokyo Olympics in 2020. But Cuban boxers like Julio La Cruz could never hope to earn big bucks in the ring unless they left their country. But now, things have changed. On May 20th, Cuba's national boxing team, called Los Domadores, made history. They took part in a professional competition in Aguascalientes, Mexico.
Pesando 90 kilos con 400 gramos en su debut profesional, el doble campeón olímpico de Camagüey, Cuba, Julio César La Cruz.
La Cruz won that fight with a knockout just a minute and 40 seconds into the second round, and all six members of the Cuban team actually won their fight with five knockouts and a victory by unanimous decision. It's a mix of power, precision, and art that makes Cuba's program the best in the world, according to Alberto Puig de la Barca. He's the president of the Cuban Federation of Boxing.
Pero nos dio la medida de cómo se había ido humanizando el boxeo profesional.
He says professional boxing is more humane nowadays, and the quality of the officiating is better than it used to be. More ethical, he says.
Este es un boxeo con mucho más exigencia.
De la Barca says he wants Cuban boxers to fight at the most competitive level. But another motivation here, he says, is money.
Por peleas que se efectúan, el boxeador gana el 80% de la bonificación de la pelea.
De la Barca says Cuban boxers will get 80% of the prize money for each fight, and the rest will be shared between the coach and the medical staff. But he didn't give any more details. At the event in Mexico, the Cuban team wore matching red shorts instead of gear with brand names from sponsors. But Cuban fighter Julio La Cruz said he was thrilled to be able to fight as a professional for the first time. In an interview with Cuban journalists right after his debut, La Cruz said that was a historic day and that the best of Cuban fighters is yet to come. For The World, I am Tibi Saisea.
A warning from a nuclear weapons watchdog. Global nuclear arsenals are expected to grow. That's a conclusion from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's annual report. The Swedish body found that the 9 nuclear-armed countries are increasing or upgrading their arsenals. Hans Christensen was one of the authors of the report. He's an associate senior fellow with the Stockholm Institute. So, Hans, which countries are growing their nuclear weapons stockpiles?
Well, there appear to be about 6 of them. It's Russia, China, the United Kingdom, India and Pakistan, and North Korea.
And why? This comes after a steady decline since the end of the Cold War in nuclear stockpiles. Is that right?
Yeah, for very different reasons. The Chinese are building up their arsenal at a significant pace because of a combination of factors, including fear of a disarming first strike, but also because they want to be a big military power. Russia is introducing a number of new types of weapons. There's an increase expected over the next decade in that. The United Kingdom has decided that it wanted to increase its stockpile also, apparently in an attempt to increase the number of weapons that can target Russia. And India and Pakistan, of course, are continuing their bilateral, if you will, arms buildup where they're competing with each other. And then we have North Korea that we all know is testing ballistic missiles again and might be testing a nuclear weapon underground very shortly.
Your report did find, though, that the 2 biggest nuclear powers, the U.S. and Russia, their stockpiles did not grow from 2021 to 2022. So what makes you think that they will be growing over the next decade?
What reduced in those countries were the total inventories, and the total inventories includes warheads that have been retired and are in a queue for being dismantled, but they're not usable weapons, so to speak. But if you only look at the arsenals, those weapons that are usable, then in Russia, it's ticking up again, and in the United States, it's leveling out, and we might see an increase within the next decade, potentially.
So if there's this trend that you're identifying of more nuclear weapons in the world, what does that tell us about security and stability in the world?
Well, it tells us that the idea of nuclear arsenals being reduced to low levels and eventually eliminated, that vision is under attack, and the trend is clearly not going in that direction. This is a wake-up call to the arms control and non-proliferation communities out there in the world, that they need to beef up their efforts because we're now beginning to swing in the other direction. And the reason is that nuclear weapon states are beginning to adhere more importance to nuclear weapons. They're using them more directly in threatening and more overtly when they talk about nuclear weapons and the importance it plays in their military strategies. So there are several things that sort of feed into this direction we're heading in now, but it's clearly moving in the wrong direction.
And you mentioned China, that it's in the middle of a substantial expansion of its nuclear weapons arsenal. How important is that when we talk about all of the countries we're speaking about here? And what exactly are we seeing in China?
Well, in China, we see by Chinese standard, a significant increase of its nuclear forces. It's unprecedented, essentially, compared to anything China has done before. This has probably more to do with China's choice about wanting to be a world-class military power. They have a lot of money now and all that, so they can build it up. We're counting currently something in the order of 330 missile silos under construction. And this is a country that used to have 20 missile silos. This is a significant development. And that helps fuel, of course, how the United States, and to some extent also Russia, but certainly India, view the threat that they're facing.
Mm. Finally, what would you like to see happen in the near future to reverse this trend? Is there a template for a treaty or an agreement that could realistically be implemented?
We're sort of in the last phase now where by 2026, the last nuclear arms control treaty between the United States and Russia will expire. If no treaty is replacing it or no new agreement, then the world will, for the first time since the 1970s, have no limits on nuclear force developments. And so this is a significant risk to the world because it can really trigger sort of an escalation of reactions, military reactions. And so what we need to see is a combination of new agreements that try to put a lid on these developments. The clear challenge here is that the nuclear weapon states, A, need to sit down and talk to each other again, And the non-nuclear weapon states need to increase their pressure on the nuclear weapon states to do exactly that.
Hans Christensen is an associate senior fellow with the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute Weapons of Mass Destruction Program, speaking with us about their annual report on armaments, disarmament, and international security. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For the past few months, scientists have been puzzling over a mystery in the Black Sea. Hundreds of dolphins are dying and washing up on the shores of Ukraine, Turkey, and Bulgaria. The war in Ukraine has made it difficult for scientists to investigate the cause of these deaths. But one theory is that sonar from military ships is interfering with dolphins' ability to navigate. The world's Duri Buskerin joined a group of Turkish researchers trying to find answers on the southern coast of the Black Sea.
When you're looking for dolphins, marine biologist Dayaka Öztürk says you follow the birds.
Because the dolphins are feeding on the fish, and the fish come up to the surface, and then the birds can also feed on them. Birds follow dolphins, and we follow birds.
Twice a month, Öztürk and her colleagues at the Turkish Marine Research Foundation use a small wooden fishing boat to make their way up the Bosphorus Strait, eyes trained for a splash or a fin out of the water. As we reach a green protected area, far from the bustle of Istanbul, there's a pod of bottlenose dolphins with their calves.
Because they know where the fish is. A lot of times they are feeding, but sometimes they show the behavior of like resting.
Hundreds of dolphins live in the narrow, polluted waters of the Bosphorus, dodging shipping traffic and litter from a city of 16 million people. It's not an easy life, but they manage. As the boat heads off to another feeding area, marine biologist Ayhan Dede sits on the prow, a huge camera in his lap, so he can try to identify individuals and families.
Some dolphins over there.
They're smart, he says. You can watch them throwing fish around to play with their pups. He's installed underwater microphones or hydrophones to help him hear them talking to each other.
Muhteşem bir gürültü var. İnanılmaz. Yani kulaklık
atmak. It's this multi-sensory noise, he says. It's unbelievable. He emails me a clip later. Dolphins use echolocation to hunt, navigate, and avoid predators, especially in murky waters where they can't see well. Their hearing is super sensitive, and when it's damaged, it can be life-threatening. That's why this spring, when hundreds of dolphins began washing up on the shores of countries along the Black Sea, scientists wondered if underwater Navy sonar systems used in the Russian invasion of Ukraine were to blame.
It's a very loud sound. It's used for finding other vessels and submarines underwater.
Simon Elwin is the director of South Africa-based Sea Search. He says research on underwater mammals exposed to naval exercises shows that they respond to this loud sonar the same way they would respond to a killer whale attack.
They get a big fright, they rush to the surface, and they scatter.
Deep diving animals can get the bends if they surface too quickly, the same way a scuba diver might, Elwin says. They can stampede. Explosions or loud underwater noises can also permanently damage a dolphin's hearing, and therefore their ability to use echolocation to hunt, navigate, and find each other. Elwin says this research was done during peacetime, when Navy boats were trying to prevent damage to marine life.
You can imagine that in war, a lot of the health and safety protocols or environmental protocols do fall aside.
Like any scientist, Ayaka Öztürk knows it'll take data and time to see whether the Russian invasion of Ukraine is to blame for the recent dolphin deaths. They could also be dying from a viral infection or other causes. She says proving acoustic trauma is hard.
Their inner ear gets damaged. It can't be seen from outside, but if you cut this specimen and if you see the inner ear, like they have like a little hair like this, you know, for it's a sensory organ. You can see them actually damaged.
And in order to prove that a dolphin's hearing was damaged in the war, Öztürk needs to take a sample from an animal that has died less than 24 hours earlier and send it to a specialized lab in Spain. So despite regular survey trips and a network of fishermen, coast guards, and city cleanup crews to alert her when there's a death, she's still looking.
It's a theory, and it's one of the hypotheses we're trying to test. But since we don't have any evidence yet, I can't really say that.
Anecdotally, she says she's seeing an unusual number of open water dolphins in the Bosphorus Strait. That could mean they're seeking refuge from activity in the Black Sea.
When we see common dolphins, they usually just swim really fast and pass. And this year they tend to stay around, which is, yeah, unusual. But we don't really know. We have to ask them, why are you here?
If only they could tell us. For the world, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, yay!
This Saturday, an annual race across the Welsh countryside returned after a pandemic hiatus. A 22-mile competition, man or woman versus horse. 1,000 runners competed against 50 horses and their riders. And this year was only the third time a human has won since the race began in 1980. It was Ricky Lightfoot, a 37-year-old from England, with, you have to admit, the perfect name for this story.
You know, it was great to win and everything, but it was the experience. I was so looking forward to doing a race where you actually got to race a horse.
Lightfoot said racing and being passed by a horse is surreal.
It was absolutely crazy, like the sound of the horse galloping up the hill and coming past you. And at the time, I had my head down, it was raining and the wind was blowing, so I didn't hear it straight away. And then all of a sudden, it just came by.
The course took competitors through Welsh forests and grasslands. The day after his win, Lightfoot returned to work as a firefighter in the town of Maryport in northern England. He lives there with his partner and two kids. Besides bragging rights, Lightfoot took home a nice prize. It's a rolling jackpot, which means each year a horse wins, the prize goes up by about $600. It's been 7 races without a human winner, so Lightfoot pocketed about $4,000.
Just had a nice holiday away, and it's just paid for that full holiday, so it's great to win a bit of cash along with beating the horses.
Next year, a horse, any horse, is heavily favored to win again. Sub-Saharan Africa has fewer neurologists per capita than any other region in the world. A neurology program established 4 years ago in Zambia is aiming to address that. And as doctors trained there begin practicing, some misconceptions about neurological diseases in the region have been upended, like the idea that multiple sclerosis there is rare. Farah Dasani is a journalist and U.S.-based neurologist who recently trained in Lusaka, the capital of Zambia. She came across this story working in that new neurology unit.
Nala Piri relaxes on the couch in her suburban home. She listens to her son Sangu sing hymns from church earlier that day.
That's a song he doesn't know the words of, but he'll sing anyways.
She first noticed something was off soon after Sangu was born in 2016.
I couldn't walk the way I used to. I was limping and I'd literally be dragging my leg along.
Piri returned to the hospital. Her x-rays came out normal and the doctor wasn't sure how to explain it. She began physical therapy, but her walking never fully recovered. Soon after, other problems would arise that began to affect her work as a banker.
After some time, I'd notice I wasn't able to write. I would hold the mouse and not know that I was pressing on it.
In the span of 3 years, Piri had been evaluated by 10 doctors. Each had a different diagnosis: tendonitis, sciatica, stroke. By 2019, her leg had become weaker and increasingly numb. At the age of 34, she was now walking with a cane. It was one Sunday that this caught the attention of a member in her congregation.
I was at church and noticed a young woman with a small child who was walking with a cane, and I overheard her talking about how her problems had come back yet again.
Dr. Deanna Saylor is a neurologist from Johns Hopkins University who has been based in Lusaka since 2018. She specializes in multiple sclerosis. Nala Piri recalls that chance encounter with Dr. Saylor.
Then she stopped me and said, oh, hi, I was listening to your conversation and I'm a neurologist. She introduced herself and she said, I'd like to give you a consultation. So I said, oh, yeah, I'm willing to come because I want to give a name to whatever I'm suffering from.
The next day, Piri met with Dr. Saylor in her clinic at University Teaching Hospital. She ordered a workup, including an MRI of her brain and spinal cord. The results were unequivocal. After 3 years, Piri finally had an answer to her symptoms.
I don't feel that any of the doctors had considered multiple sclerosis.
Most cases of MS are found in North America and Europe, Dr. Saylor says that, like most other medical providers around the world, she was taught that MS is very rare among Black Africans.
I think that dogma is just so strong that people have stopped looking for it.
An estimated 2.8 million people worldwide live with multiple sclerosis. It's a disease in which the body's immune system attacks the nerves of the brain, spinal cord, and eyes.
And so over time, people can become quite disabled if they're not treated.
We don't know what exactly causes MS. The disease tends to affect adults beginning in their 20s and 30s, people who live further from the equator are more likely to have it, and this is thought to be related to vitamin D. But how did we come to the understanding that MS was so rare in sub-Saharan Africa? It's a question that Dr. Saylor's been exploring.
I mean, I think the short answer is that people equated the absence of data to the absence of disease.
Alarmingly few studies exist on MS prevalence in the region. Dr. Saylor argues that historical estimates were also heavily biased. They were based on research out of South Africa during apartheid or from private hospitals in countries during and soon after colonialism. But getting a better idea of the disease here also requires technology and people to diagnose it.
We always like to say here, is it the absence of MS in sub-Saharan Africa, or is it the absence of neurologists and MRIs? My name is Mashina Chomba. I've been a neurologist for past year or so amongst a group that is the first group of Zambian neurologists.
Dr. Mashina Chomba trained in the new neurology residency program at University Teaching Hospital. It was established in 2018 by Dr. Deanna Saylor. The program has trained 7 neurologists to date and established a hospital service and clinic.
We got to see patients with different presentations that were sent to our care. We got to see that we have patients that fit the description of multiple sclerosis.
They've diagnosed and treated more than 24 patients living with MS, patients like Muchimba Kabeta. Twice a year, Kabeta finds himself here in the chemotherapy unit at the University Teaching Hospital. He's getting an infusion of the medication rituximab to help prevent flares of his MS. Kabeta puts down his book as a nurse adjusts the IV in his arm.
No, I've never been a patient for. I haven't been a patient for too long. So my mind is still in denial.
He was diagnosed after almost 10 years of unexplained symptoms. Kabeta had been training to become an orthopedic surgeon, but ultimately had to stop because of his disabilities. Even as a physician himself, he never considered the possibility he could have MS as an African man.
And that's the very first step. If we can just say, what if, could it be this? I think that would go a long way in MS awareness amongst the doctors.
Along with their research, Saylor and Chomba are educating the community. Dr. Chomba says this realization about MS follows a pattern when a country lacks medical expertise and resources in a particular field. It can lead to misconceptions, like when Zambia lacked oncologists until the 1990s.
We trained the first oncologists in Zambia, and we started diagnosing a number of cancers that we thought were very, very rare.
After being diagnosed with MS, Nala Piri has been on treatment and hasn't had a flare since. She hopes others will never have to go through the same struggle that she did.
I'm open to speak to whoever will listen so that even when they see another person experiencing something similar, it doesn't have to take that long.
Since that chance encounter with Dr. Saylor, Piri gave birth to another daughter and became a mother of 3. But now, she no longer uses a cane. For The World, I'm Farah Dasani, Lusaka, Zambia.
If you miss one of our shows on the radio, you can always catch up online. Check out our recent story on Ghana, which is trying to fix a massive fertilizer shortage. The African Development Bank has pledged more than $1 billion, but small farmers worry it's already too late to avert a food crisis. That's at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
Before we go, the podcast you just listened to is available free and on demand because listeners like you support our work. If you value our independent, fact-based journalism, please consider making a contribution before our fundraiser ends on June 30th. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate, or you can follow the link in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.